Ari, what is new in the hospital's COVID ward this week?
We're seeing that the peak probably occurred in hospitals around our area. Overall, if you look up IHME COVID projections, you'll see in Florida, the hospital resource use is starting to come down. We're seeing daily infections clearly locally are lower and lower. You could look up Miami-Dade COVID tracker. The number percentage today, something like 29% positivity. Yesterday, it was 34%. So we're seeing a downtrend in local infection rates, and the hospital rates lags 2 to 3 weeks behind.
I never want to get Omicron. The plan is to lay low till herd immunity. But Omicron is so infectious, and if I take off my mask in the future, I assume that I'll just get sick. So am I delaying the inevitable? Will I get infected in 3 or 6 months or a year as soon as I return to my normal behavior? Omicron is just not going away. Someone in my community will have it. What should I do?
Well, if the numbers locally are down, the numbers around you are going to be obviously lower. So the likelihood of you being infected are not going to be high. If the percentage positivity rate drops below 10%, there's no reason for you to wear a mask. The better question I think you should ask is whether or not you want to get the Omicron. If you're triple boosted and not with many risk factors, maybe it's better for you in the long run. It's not such a crazy concept to think that it will afford you better immunity down the road.
There's been a lot of press that T cells are better than boosters for long-term defense against COVID and its future variants. Do you think it makes sense to try to get infected with Omicron because the known consequences are not that bad? And if so, when and how should we do it?
I mean, I personally don't advise people sniffing positive COVID patients' mucus to try to get it. But I think it makes sense not to be so overly careful that you're inhibiting your lifestyle, assuming you don't have a lot of risk factors. If you're 65 and older with coronary disease, hypertension, diabetes, you're better off waiting for the therapeutics down the line, which are going to be really rigorous and good. It makes sense, even against the future variant. But if you're young and healthy, there is perhaps some truth that you could, if you're triple boosted, meaning you have two vaccines and a booster, if you get Omicron, then you're like super immune because you have both T cells and you have B cells ramped up for the next variant down the line. I personally don't believe there's going to be another crazy COVID variant because I think the Omicron will really be the bomb that covered everybody across the world. But in case there is another variant down the road, SARS-CoV-3, 4, 5, you're probably better off if you had this Omicron, which is the lightest one we've seen, assuming you've triple boosted.
Ari, I'm triple boosted. I was infected with COVID alpha in early December 2020. Would you still advise that I get Omicron as well?
I wouldn't advise that you get it, but I wouldn't inhibit the lifestyle so much that you really feel like, oh my gosh, I can't go to that bar mitzvah or wedding. I'm speaking more to the people that have had Omicron and had two vaccines or had the booster. They should really feel like, hey, I don't necessarily need to wear my mask around. The UK announced yesterday, we're no longer doing vaccine passport and we're not mandating indoor masks anymore. I think that makes sense to me. However, I feel like in America, it's going to be tough because President Biden just sent out 400 million masks. So it's not the time to say, oh, we don't have to wear masks now. It's not going to be politically appropriate. But it's something for us to start getting used to.
When I was a kid, parents would sometimes host chickenpox parties where kids would be invited over to catch it. Ari, are you recommending Omicron parties?
So not having Omicron parties, because doing that is not showing sensitivity to the people with the higher risk factors, the 65 and older. You're not going out positively trying to get the disease because you might infect somebody who's immunocompromised, but you don't have to be so overly protective. I just recently had a bar mitzvah. Many people didn't come because they were scared of Omicron, and I totally understand. But also, these are healthy people who've already had three vaccines, you could bend a little bit at this point.
I probably should have attended your son's bar mitzvah. Next topic, brain fog. After I was discharged from the hospital with COVID, my brain was clearly compromised. I couldn't remember names. I left the hospital on Christmas Day 2020 and the NFL football season had just ended. And I'm a big Bears fan. I follow the team pretty closely. And I quizzed myself to name as many Chicago Bears players on the roster as I could, and I could only come up with a single name. where previously I could have named 20 players. And then over the following 6 months, I noticed substantial improvement, not only with names, but with word retrieval as needed in conversations. I had brain fog. What is the medical condition that causes this problem? And why does it go away? And why should patients feel confident that it will?
If you're triple vaccinated, you're less likely to have brain fog if you are infected. This is studied in Israel at Bar-Ilan University. You could look it up. They looked at previously infected people who were vaccinated versus unvaccinated, and the numbers were pretty striking. The incidence of brain fog and post-COVID syndrome were much less in the vaccinated. So it has more than just infection prevention utility, but against brain fog.
Do you think that the reason why the vaccinated are having less brain fog is because the disease is less harmful to them?
As you see, the pathophysiology behind it is real, and it has to do with cytokine storms, and it's going to be lower in those patients that are vaccinated. The question is, what is brain fog? Like you mentioned that you lost memory. Is it dizziness? Is it headaches? Is it fatigue? It's a very vague, they call it post-COVID syndrome.
For me, my brain was working at two-thirds the usual speed. I couldn't make witty remarks on time. I couldn't get word retrieval or name recognition right. So it wasn't like I had headaches. I was just dumb.
You looked like you were a little akinetic, like a slow speed. Go Google Professor Akiko Iwasaki. They published a very interesting article on the pathophysiology behind COVID. I'm looking at mice studies showing cytokine elevation in the CSF, even after a mild infection in the mice. So certain cytokines are increased. The one that they were talking about is CCL11, but there's a whole list of cytokines that are increased 7 days and then even weeks after a mild infection. It actually gives some solace to some of the patients knowing that they're not making up their symptoms. But the good news is usually it does subside over months in some cases, but it does go away. I've seen some really terrible cases of post-COVID syndrome fog, and they have, by and large, gone away over time. That study that she also looked at a thing called microglial activity in the white matter of the brains, which they found in autopsy studies as well in humans, showing that there are certain areas in the brain that are affected by the virus, not directly, but by distal inflammation and cytokine release, including what you described in the hippocampal areas, which is important for memory. So it does affect different parts of the brain.
My understanding is that the brain's natural defenses protected against most viral attacks, but that was clearly not the case for COVID. Do you think that patients' loss of taste or smell is indicative of a viral attack to the brain, or is it something else? And why do conditions improve over time, with most problems resolving themselves in 3 to 6 months?
The loss of taste and smell, which we found out early here in our experience in Miami, but it's not seen in the Omicron variant for whatever reason. But I can't tell you the pathophysiology behind it. It's not clear if it's direct to the smell cell, to the olfactory cells, because it's right near the nasopharynx, or if it's a cytokine-induced interference. My opinion with Omicron, where we are seeing some people that lose their taste and smell, that's related to the sinusitis, to the stuffiness regular.
Right.
But to the actual COVID, my gestalt was that it was actual nerve damage, nerve infiltration of the olfactory cells. In some people, it took 6 months. That's more nerve damage, and then it would slowly recover.
So why is there brain fog? What causes it, and why do patients recover?
I think that those cytokines eventually go down. First of all, the majority of people don't have the brain fog, but a large portion of people do have. I think it's related to exactly what Professor Iwasaki was showing, that there is a cytokine inflammation that's causing the brain to be a little messed up. And then boom, you're back to normal.
New topic. How did the medical community determine best practices for COVID treatment in real time? Hospitals faced a novel disease simultaneously worldwide. There was experimentation. Doctors started with treatments that worked for other viruses. Some worked, some didn't. How did the discovery process work? How did the medical community work with each other? And how were the best ideas implemented and the worst rejected?
I think a lot of the information spread by social media initially, And it was actually a detriment to us all that virus started in China for many reasons, one of which is because they are really closed. I was able to go online initially and look up at the Chinese health official recommendations for COVID. And that's where I personally had ideas about convalescent plasma, interferon treatment, because we were learning you could actually translate their journals, their recommendations. Their CDC in America, let's say Harvard, Yale, big institutions, they were keeping their protocols initially to themselves because nothing was evidence-based. If you look at the first NIH guidelines on COVID treatment, it goes over all these things like Kaletra, Plaquenil, Ivermectin, plasma, and it says nothing is evidence-based, nothing is proven. So we can't recommend anything. So you read this document, which is like 130 pages, and it's telling you you can't do anything. So thankfully, I think at that time, believe it or not, the government did the right thing. They were not stopping local hospitals from treating the way you felt. The places like One Drive here locally, they did a great job. They're heroes because they tried. They were still a little late. Like, we could have had an established plasma program earlier on. The other interesting aspect to this is that there is an active ACTIV arm of the NIH, which looks at funky therapies like plasma. And there are companies that are looking at polyclonal antibodies, which is plasma from like cows. Look at this company, SAB Therapeutics. I can't fully understand it, but it's a cow that is genetically altered to have the immune system of a human. And then they inject the organism into the cow and they develop polyclonal antibodies. It's plasma. So they inject that into the patient and they're going to have a positive trial soon. We won't need that because we're going to have Paxlovid, Molnupiravir, and monoclonal antibodies here. We won't need it for this pandemic, but it will be useful for the next, God forbid, pandemic.
Ari, every episode we end with a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about this week?
I'm optimistic. I think the masks are going to start coming off and people are going to celebrate for the holidays coming up. I think the infections are exponentially declining. The actual number locally is that it dropped by 3,000 cases a day. Last week was like 65,000. The week before was 87,000. So we're coming down pretty fast.
That's good news. Ari, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Jim and Ari for joining us today. That ends today's session. I want to make a plug for next week's show. I am so excited to be joined by one of my best friends, Chris Reback. Chris is a former 60 Minutes producer who now creates his own morning curated newsletter. He's also a podcaster. His podcast is called Chris Reback Conversations. I hope to learn from Chris about the changing world of media and the future of podcasting. It's going to be really fun. If you're interested in listening to a replay of today's What Happens Next program or any of our previous episodes, or you wish to read a transcript, you can find them on our website, whathappensnextin6minutes.com. Replays are also available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. Goodbye.